Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status helps educators at every level take control of student data for increased outcomes and meaningful stakeholder engagement. Find out more at schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 262, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. This episode, just how much has chronic absenteeism spiked since the COVID pandemic? We'll examine the data. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each episode, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we hear from a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. In this episode, we talk to an expert about media literacy and how teachers might navigate our upcoming presidential election. Hello, friends. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by friend, assistant superintendent, and co-host of the Class Dismissed podcast, Dr. Christina Pollard. Christina, how are you doing today?
I am fantastic. The sun is shining. Spring is kicking. I can't complain.
That is all excellent news, and I agree 100% with you, except on the sun part. We're missing the sun right now. So I've got a story that I want to dive into today, and it's a topic that has bubbled up time and time again over the past several years, but it really hit my radar because the New York Times had posted an article about it last Friday, so fairly recently, and it was all about absences. And the headline was, "Why School Absences Have Exploded Almost Everywhere." And I can't help but kind of have to talk about that because I agree with a lot of what I see in the article. So I'm curious from somebody of your position, what your perspective on absences is.
Well, let me just first start by saying, we truly started seeing an increase in chronic absenteeism, seems like right when the pandemic hit. And as schools transitioned back in from virtual learning, some completely traditional, some toggling between traditional and hybrid, we began to notice that a lot of children did not return to school for different reasons. Some switched schools, some went private, a lot of students went homeschool, and some just did not return as they should have and as, you know, required. As time began to, you know, go by, and we really kind of have gotten away from saying anything about the pandemic, we're still noticing that attendance has not improved. And I think there's a lot of pressures on families that it's involved in. Think about during COVID, how many people lost their jobs, finances were impacted, families were impacted by deaths in the family, putting hardships on different families, raising children, just trying to survive. But at the same time, I think that it also impacted education in a way where teachers were leaving the profession. We were in a major teacher crisis, shortage crisis. I think a lot of those things are impacting how people feel about public education and about school in general. We're still struggling with, you know, normal sicknesses and things of that nature. But I really think that there are other factors in impacting people just really supporting school attendance and making sure their children are in school. What does the article say?
So yeah, here's the data. And the New York Times posts a chart, very easy to digest. And it's basically looking at pre-pandemic. They have no reliable data actually during that 2020-21 window. So there's really no data for there. Mm-hmm. And then they have post-pandemic, which they categorize as 2021 all the way through 2023. So when you see that pre-pandemic, the chronic absenteeism, which is defined according to them by missing 10% of a school year, was around 13 to 15%. 2019 to 2020, they had 13%. Mm-hmm. In 2021, so post-pandemic, they reported chronic absenteeism up to 28%. And then in 2022 and 23, when you kind of think like, all right, things are getting back to normal, it was at 26%. So it was still way above that 13 and 15% range pre-pandemic.
And a lot of people don't realize that your chronic absenteeism impacts school funding.
Well, and that's, I'm glad you said that, because that was kind of something that I wanted to bring up, is because it's been that way in Mississippi for a while, right? We've been dealing with that for at least a decade, I think. And I want to say California started initiating maybe some laws that were similar in other states. Like, I feel like it's kind of slowly been rolling out. So it's like there's even more incentive for school districts across the country to do something about this.
To improve it. That's right.
And it seems to be going the opposite direction. So the New York Times are like, all right, so what's going on, right? And then I'm not going to break down all their data because I'll just be talking about numbers the whole time, but they break it down in socioeconomic class and so forth. And the basic story is it's the same. It doesn't matter which group you're in or not. It seems to be going up.
Well, before you break the data down, let me also share that chronic absenteeism does not just impact school funding, but it's connected to your dropout rate, your graduation mm-hmm. rate, the success of student performance.
Right.
So it's critical.
And I guess I'm going to speak for me personally, and this is kind of what they touched on in the article. It says, quote, "The trends suggest that something fundamentally has shifted in American childhood and the culture of school in ways that may be long-lasting. What was once a deeply ingrained habit, wake up, catch the bus, report to class, is now something more tenuous." And then it says from a psychologist, it says, quote, "Our relationship with school became optional," said Katie Rosenbaum, a psychologist and associate research professor with the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke University. Do you agree with that? Our relationship with school became optional?
I do agree with that. And I guess that's pretty much what I was saying when I talked about how people feel about the school setting. Their feelings changed when we were shut down for the pandemic and families began to see, well, the school can actually go on here at home, that there were ways mm-hmm. around not having face-to-face instruction. I think that it changed their belief that it was absolutely necessary to report to the building every single day. And so some parents were finding their own ways to educate their children.
I will admit that we kind of shifted a little bit to what I will call a YOLO, you only live once type
yeah.
mindset. And I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but it's kind of like, I'll give you an example. Next week, right? There's a total solar eclipse going through parts of the country. Mm-hmm. I believe that it's an opportunity for my child to see something that she won't have an opportunity to see for another 22 years. It's a learning experience, but there's school and I'm in Florida. So we were going to fly to Austin. The weather looks bad. We've rerouted. We're going to Pittsburgh and driving towards Cleveland. And I wanted to see this, and she's going to have to miss 2 days of school in order to do that. And my mindset's kind of like, YOLO, like this is something that I'm just going to pull her out of school and do. And I don't, where before the pandemic, I would have looked at that differently. I would have been like, no, we got school, we can't do it. And I don't know why I've changed like that, but that's how I feel personally.
Well, and so a lot of other parents feel that way too. I think that we have so many people making decisions for schools that are not directly linked to schools and that are not educators, that they also just can't see how just the perception of schools and the feelings about schools have changed. And a lot of it has to do with decisions that were made for schools and how much it's impacting our educators. If teachers aren't speaking positively or feeling good about where they report to work or the profession that they're serving in, don't you think that that's going to trickle down to families under pressure from trying to make it, you know, to make ends meet and provide the best opportunities for their children? But then families that are just exhausted with trying to survive all of the crazy dynamics right now.
Yes, 100% agree. I think that is a very valid perspective on it. I mean, I don't know where we go from here. One thing that's interesting, and you may or may not want to share this information, but isn't there like a certain time of year where schools are judged on absenteeism as opposed to other times of year where they're not?
Absolutely. So let me just say this, that September is Attendance Awareness Month nationally, but in the state of Mississippi, October and November are critical attendance months. Schools have campaigns and they are driving how important it is to attend school, because those 2 months, the average daily attendance for both October and November is what they utilize to help determine funding for the next school year. Just those 2 months. For instance, in September, we develop attendance awareness committees. We think about fun activities that we can do to draw attention. We develop our social media campaign, any flyers or handouts that we want to go home. And then we have campaigns where we'll invite parents to come to a football game and give them attendance awareness information, pizza parties, just different rewards for students who have perfect attendance, but not just perfect attendance, improved attendance. And then another thing that's really important, though, is to have checkpoints along the way to communicate with those parents when the child has already reached 3 absences, because generally you monitor 3, 5, and 10, because by 12, you're looking at a child who's already set themselves behind by 2 years instructionally if they've missed that much school.
Every episode of this podcast, 260 plus, we've had our sponsors, School Status. And I would not be doing my job if I didn't mention this, because School Status, they have since merged with other companies. There's lots of other companies that are underneath their umbrella, and they've been in the process for like the past 2 years of like redesigning their software and taking these skill sets from these other companies and bringing it into the School Status umbrella. But they had purchased a company out of California called SINA. And SINA has been in the attendance game, I think, for 20 plus years. Like before, like the internet was big even. I think they were kind of like, you know, starting it. Mm-hmm. And they actually like have this whole like program where they have a printing press and they have special language and proprietary information from studying this for 20 years to where they're doing mail outs specifically for attendance, like not just after the student's absent, even beforehand, right? They try to have a proactive approach to it. And so anyhow, I say that if anybody's listening and they are looking for a possible solution, School Status does have one now, which formerly was SINA. And I think they call that product Attend. And I'm sure they can explain it much better than I can.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's pretty neat. And I've seen some of the, like their pamphlets and stuff. Like it's very bright and colorful. Like, so you go to your mailbox if you're a parent and you open it up and it's saying like why attendance is important, and along with other language in there that's supposed to like capture, you know, parents' minds. And of course they do it all through text message and stuff as well. But I think something about receiving a letter from your school related to attendance is maybe going to grab your attention a little bit more than just text message.
Correct. I think you have to use each mode of communication sometimes for certain families, because they're hustling, they're working, they're, you know, just taken day by day. And so multiple forms of communication, I think, it's key. And of course, we know the kids don't always bring the handouts home either.
Right. That's the truth. And so where do you think we're going to be, let's say, 2 years from now? Do you think that like we'll naturally come back down to those 15% chronic absentee levels? Or do you think like these 20% numbers are here to stay?
You know, that's hard to judge. There's so many things in the air related to education right now. But let's just be hopeful that it'll settle down, because at the end of the day, instruction is critical for our children. And we want them to be prepared so that they can have very successful and bright futures. And I just want to say, as an advocate for every child, that they need to be at school and need to be at school regularly, not just to high perform on an assessment, not to necessarily win a reward, so that they can receive a high quality education and be prepared for either college or the workforce.
There was one little interesting nugget in this article too that I want to share with everybody. And it's basically saying that absenteeism is contagious. It was Michael Gottfried, mm-hmm. a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education. His research found that when 10% of a student's classmates are absent on a given day, that another student is more likely to be absent the following day. Like it almost like bleeds into these other classes. Like, hey, no one else is here, so I don't really want to go tomorrow. And I thought, oh, wow, that's interesting. All right, Christina, are you ready for today's bright idea?
Bring it on.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is here to talk about media literacy and the impact of our upcoming presidential election on curriculum. Andrea De La Cerda is the founder and CEO of Candula. Candula is a strategic communications company that helps nonprofits, entrepreneurs, and educational institutions. Andrea, welcome to Class Dismissed.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk about this because this is a what I would call a current topic, right? Like, here we are. I think it's fair to say that we know at least two of the candidates that we're going to probably be voting for in 2024, like it or not. It's going to be a rematch of Joe Biden and former President Trump. And gosh, I can't help but like put myself in the shoes of educators out there and think, how do I work this into the curriculum? Like, it's important, but it's also so divided out there.
Exactly.
In this country. So what say you?
Well, look, I mean, it's interesting. There was a recent statistic that I came across that actually said that the interest in the election this time around is a little lower than it was the first time. So we might actually see some young voters dropping off, sort of been there, done that, you know, that was nice, and they're moving on. But with the case of media literacy, I think what's so frightening, given that it is such a divisive topic already, potentially, I think what's scary is that when students, and we're talking about Gen Z here, so ages, you know, between 12 and 24, mm-hmm. These are the students who are looking to TikTok for their information. They're looking to YouTube for their information. They are looking for entertaining information, something that makes them laugh. So all of these things lead to the potential for extreme misinformation in their hands to then, you know, allow them to kind of take a side. So it's really, taking a step back, it's really dangerous. This is the first presidential election that we're going into with young voters and AI. I think it's safe to say that, you know, the last presidential election, it was not, AI was not really something that people could interact with every day, but we can now. And now, you know, how do you know that what you're viewing is even real? How Right. do you know this video is real? How do you know this really happened? So the potential for fake news is at an all-time high, and we're not providing, as a nation, media literacy at the level that our students need it. And this is where we're at right now. This is the day and age that we live in. Media is everywhere. And if we don't figure out a way to teach our young people, even as early as kindergarten, how to decipher real information from false information, then we're really heading down a dangerous path, in my opinion.
I'm reflecting on, I guess, the past two election cycles in my mind. And while AI is new, I think Photoshop's been around for over a decade, right? And I remember, like, people in my workplace coming up to me and saying, like, hey, look at this picture of Obama doing this or Joe Biden doing this. And then I'm kind of like, well, let me show you Snopes. Here it is. Like, this, that what you're looking at has been altered, or, you know. But yeah, with AI, it's going to be even easier. And you make a good point. Like, I feel like the Photoshop stuff was maybe tricking our older population. This is going to be very much, like you said, on TikTok, and we see what can happen with not just photos, but even video now and voice mm-hmm. and so forth. I mean, where does the media literacy discussion start in the classroom? Do you think it starts in the libraries or with every teacher in government class?
I really think it needs to be much more widespread than it is now. I mean, today, we have about 18 states that have some sort of legislation around media literacy, but only two states have really made it widespread to the point that it is a required course starting in kindergarten. And just like English class, it's a required class in every year that you're in school. So those states, Delaware and New Jersey, have really taken the lead there. But the rest, you know, we've 18 other states that, you know, it's some communities offer it on a certain year, but it's not on a widespread basis. And I think, you know, look, this, we are living in, you know, this day and age where media is everywhere. Like I said, it's just, this is where we're at. And so I think we need to be really responsive and proactive in making sure that we are teaching our young people as early as possible how to decipher what's real and what's not. You know, and that's in order to make educated decisions, they have to be able to know how to do that.
I open up this discussion kind of, all right, let's talk about politics and presidential election, which is appropriate and timely. But is it important to even have that media literacy discussion if you are uncomfortable as a teacher and you don't want to attach it to politics? I mean, for example, I was talking to my 8-year-old, who's now 9, but when she was 8, and she was saying, we live in Orlando, we're near Disney World. And she's like, I want to go to Hershey, Pennsylvania to, you know, go to the parks up there. And I'm like, look, you understand that, like, there's really good theme parks here in Orlando. Like, we don't need to go to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And I said, you also need to understand, like, she's watching these videos on YouTube where they're essentially probably paid influencers who were like, come to Hershey, you know, this is awesome, look at this roller coaster. And so I kind of explained to her, like, the whole idea of paid influencers. And she was like, well, thanks for ruining the internet, Dad. And I think I don't know. I didn't mind. I was okay with that. Like, and so I say that to say, like, should we just really be having this broad discussion with children at a young age, and should it not just be about politics?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, I used to teach in the classroom, and I taught high school and middle school. And if I were in the classroom now and thinking about how I would approach this, topic, I probably wouldn't make it about the presidential election, at least certainly not at first. You're really talking about, let's look at some examples of what we see on TikTok and then pull out, look, how do we know this is real? How do we know it's not? And in real time, actually be able to have those conversations in the classroom with students so that they start to get used to the thought process. When they do come across content, they can take a second look at it, and they can, look at it with a critical eye and know how to make that decision of whether it's right or whether it's true or not. And remember too that, our young people now, we're specifically Gen Z, as I was mentioning. I mean, that's the age where, they don't have a fully formed frontal lobe yet, right? Like, right. They're still figuring it out. They're still determining what their values are in life, what's important to them. And so we need to help them do that by also making sure that we're guiding them in the direction of truth so that they can make those decisions for themselves.
Let's talk about news for a little bit, because I'm on that cusp of millennial and Gen X. I grew up actually like watching local news. I worked in local news. I read the New York Times and so forth. Mm-hmm. Like, those are my sources. But like, my brother and other people, they send me stuff from TikTok, and I'll hop on TikTok every now and then. And it's amazing, like, what's happening on TikTok, because it'll be like a 22-year-old in a t-shirt with a microphone attached to their shirt, and they're basically green screened in front of a New York Times article or whatever source they have, and they're just retelling the story in a quick bite-sized way. And that's pretty much how I think a lot of Gen Z is getting their news now, is just like this middleman regurgitating print journalism. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, I'm seeing that. But then also what I also see is it's for entertainment purposes too. So it isn't just like, playing back the news. It's also making it funny or entertaining or throwing in a commentary, that just makes it more engaging. And I think that's sort of the slippery slope, right? But we see this in other areas too. I mean, we see this in, these talking heads on the news who make the news into commentary for just people's entertainment value. So there's this, it's strange the way that the news and entertainment are sort of meshing together to the point where, are we watching it to get true information, or are we watching it to be entertained?
So, I mean, what should we do? Is it like a, if we can't beat them, join them type thing? As an educator, should we say, all right, I know this is how you're going to get your news, so let's figure out how to navigate this? Or should we say, oh no, maybe you should go to the New York Times, or use, the Washington Post, or whatever, whatever source that you believe in? Or should we just kind of accept it for what it is?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but let's be honest. I mean, schools have tried things like banning social media in classrooms or banning cell phones altogether. And we know that doesn't work. We just know that doesn't work. Why? Because, students go home and they want to be interacting with these platforms. So they're not going to stop. So we really need to educate them that when they are on these platforms, how should they think about it? But then at the same time, I don't think we can tell them to, we want to make sure that they're directed to credible sources too.
How cognizant or how important is it to teach about possible government influence in the world of social media?
Oh boy.
Whether foreign or domestic, I guess.
Yeah. Look, yeah, I think that absolutely. Look, there's influencers out there that they, they're influencers that they follow. And guess what? There are other entities out there that influence the news as well. And so understanding who those players are, who wrote this article, where's it coming from? Is it on a blog? Is it on a credible piece of journalism? Or is it, a no-name .com, and government has a responsibility, in my mind, to make sure that students are educated from a legislative standpoint, but maybe also from a communication standpoint. This is a topic that I've been thinking about, and I even talked to my kids about it too. Like, what would help the situation? It really needs to come, I think, both from a government source of, like, whether it's PSAs, whether it's education, whatever, as well as, you know, through legislation.
Tell me what you do at Candula. Like, I mean, how you guys are a strategic communications company. Like, how are you helping educational institutions?
Yeah, we like to, this particular example of what we're talking about is one of the things that, you know, we think through when it comes to assisting schools and really making sure that they're, in the end, you know, benefiting the students and that they make sure the community knows how they're benefiting students. So what we do is we'll team up with, you know, K-12, could be higher ed. In some cases, they might have a PIO on staff. In some cases, they don't. And either way, we help them identify the important outcomes that they want to reach by the end of the year. Sometimes that's growing enrollment. Sometimes that's gaining new funding, improving their credibility in the community. A lot of times we see that with higher ed. So we identify what we want to achieve, and then we back into that with a communications plan and a lot of tactical support. A lot of times schools don't necessarily think about having to market themselves and historically maybe really haven't had to. But that's starting to change, and there are more options out there for educating children, and you know, parents are evaluating their different options. And so we want to make sure that we are really leveraging the best at an educational institution and what they have to offer, and making sure the community really understands that, and forming strong partnerships in those communities that can really ultimately benefit students at an equity level. We look at, you know, all schools to make sure that, you know, they're offering equitable opportunities for all kids. We can support with dual enrollment and communicating that out. So yeah, in a lot of different ways, depending on what it is they want to achieve.
Okay. So when you say PIO, you mean public information officer, right?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
So let's just say you're working with like a district's PIO, and what's like something, like give me a real world scenario where they're like, we want to improve our image in this way.
Mm-hmm.
What way is that?
Sure. So first, I'll start with a lot of public information officers are really centered around crisis communication a lot of times, and regular communication, maybe through a monthly newsletter to stakeholders. Mm-hmm. What we would do is think a bit more broadly about that. And a lot of times this, of course, needs to include the superintendent or, you know, the president of the college, but what really ultimately is going to move the needle? And if it's increase enrollment, we need to increase enrollment by 15% by, you know, in the next 18 months, then we back into working with them to determine how we can best do that. Whether there are programs at the institution that can be highlighted, recent awards that they've won, submitting for new awards, anything that we can do to highlight that in the community and add credibility will give parents and adult students more information when it comes to making their decisions.
Keen listeners will know what county my child goes to in here in Florida for school. But I'll say this, every week on Monday, I get an email from the superintendent, and it's actually like a video link, right? And it's like, you know, our chat with superintendent, I don't know her name, but it's like a discussion. And me as a parent, I kind of like chuckled to my wife and I was like, I don't think anyone's watching this. Like, I feel like this video is being made for an audience of one, and that's the superintendent, you know, like she likes doing the video and it gets sent out. And I mean, so like, what's your advice to a school district in terms of actually having meaningful communication to all the parents?
It's tricky. And it really is. And I have seen the tactic of like, if you just send them an email, you assume they're looking at it or they're reading it. That's not necessarily true when we're dealing with parents. They're very, very busy, just like anyone, any customer that you're trying to reach is very busy. They utilize probably multiple platforms, but they are on their phone. I think that there isn't one solution. And that's kind of that's the unfortunate side of this. There's not one solution, but that's why it takes time, it takes effort to be showing up in multiple places at once. Whether that, if that's a video, how is that video being distributed? As many channels as can be managed by the school. Now, we know that the schools, a lot of times, from a communication standpoint, are under-resourced, or they don't think they're under-resourced, but they're unresourced to be able to do this really well. Parent outreach, community outreach, student outreach, all of those are important. All of those are different messages, and they all need to be delivered in a relevant way, whether that's, you know, a pop-up on a parent's phone, look, you have a new message, or maybe it's email, but it isn't. It has to be a number of different ways.
Okay, so here's my experience, and I want you to push back and give me your thoughts. But like, okay. So my district, they use, I think School Messenger is the company, and I think it's an older platform. And originally, it probably was like just a phone call and a voicemail that was left behind. But as they've kind of grown, I think now they do text message and voicemail and email. And anyways, what ends up happening for me is like they'll have an announcement, right? And sometimes it's important, and sometimes it's not. Like, and I'll give you a not important one. It was like, hey, daylight saving time's coming tomorrow, and don't forget it might be dark in the morning, right? Like, and so I got that message with a phone call, a voicemail, a text message, and an email. And I'm like, really? Like, do I need, like, so it's almost like the boy who cried wolf. So like the next yes. time that message comes in, I'm kind of like, do I really need to listen to this? Like, what I really want to know is like, how's my kid doing in school? How'd they score on the test? And is there a special outfit that they have to wear tomorrow because it's some sort of theme day, right? Like that's what's important to me. And those are the things that might slip by that I don't want to slip by. So like, how do you coach a school to do that better?
They need, and again, this goes back to really understanding your audience. Where are they? How much time do they have? What's important to them? And making sure that your messages align with that. I would agree with you on the daylight savings time. Did that really need to go out? It probably didn't even really need to go out in the first place. You know, I don't think right. that, you know, as adults, I think we kind of get it by now. But you're right. Those are the things that I, as a parent as well, I mean, those are the things that I want to, definitely the theme days, because you don't want to be the one parent that right. doesn't know, because right. that's really embarrassing.
Right.
So those, exactly, I think really understanding what it is they want to see and not, and the more messages, the fewer views you're going to, right? So it's, mm-hmm. people only have so much time. So making sure that the right message is sent out through the right channels at the right time. You don't have to inform everybody about everything. It's just really being, just curating your messages a bit better. That's not just something that, you know, educational institutions just know how to necessarily do.
If somebody wants to learn more about Candula Communications, like how do they go about doing that?
They can find us on our website, Candula with a K, candulacommunications.com. We also have... they can also listen to our podcast as well, the Inspired Podcast, Leading the Way in Education. It's brand new. We also dig into a lot of educational topics, as just like you do, and talk about strategy and innovation around new things in the ecosystem. So
cool. What was that name again?
The Inspired Podcast, Leading the Way in Education.
Cool. I like it. Andrea, we really appreciate you chatting with us. Are you ready for today's pop quiz?
Okay. I don't know, but hit me with it.
If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Media literacy.
That's great. And you might have the same answer for the second question. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Media literacy.
Right. What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves an equal opportunity to education and to the discovery of the career that they love at a living wage.
What is the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Oh, gosh. The biggest challenge, I think, is there's just so much to teach. It's just hard to get it all in. All the things that, you know, you already have your main subjects, and then you're adding on. I mean, every year it seems we're adding more onto them. So I think that's tough.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
A wine?
I think that might be the first time that I've had that one. Usually it's like a Starbucks card or time, but that's good. I like that. I think that's a good gift. Which teacher changed your life?
Miss Wortman. Miss Christine Wortman was my English teacher in high school. And the first person to really teach me how to write a really strong essay. She became my debate coach later, and by far my best teacher ever.
And last question, which book have you read, love, and want to recommend to our listening audience?
Well, it's probably a business book. But I love Simon Sinek's Start With Why.
Yes. I have not read that book, but I have seen the videos and he's just a ton of fun to listen to. And he's all over Instagram and I'm sure on TikTok as well.
It's an incredible message and really for everyone, no matter if you're you own your business or you don't, or whatever you do in life, is just start with why.
And you know what's so neat about people like Simon Sinek, or you could say the same for like Neil deGrasse Tyson, like they may not necessarily have all the answers, but they're so good at articulating all the answers, right? Like I don't think all these ideas are original. I don't think Neil deGrasse Tyson thought of everything there is to know about astrophysics or whatever. It's just like he can articulate it to the rest of us, and so we appreciate it and we learn from them.
And in such an inspirational way too. I mean, it just hits you, I think, in a new way. Yeah. Very good.
All right. Again, you've been listening to Andrea with Candula. You can learn more at candulacommunications.com. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us on Class Dismissed.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks, Nick.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. If you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com or tweet us at Class Dismiss. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So please subscribe to the show, and we'd also appreciate it if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. On behalf of all the good people working at School Status and Christina, representing all those educators out there, thank you for listening. I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class dismissed.